Welcome to Look Ahead Radio and Viewpoints Around the World. My name is Tom Arms, and I've been writing and broadcasting about foreign affairs for almost 50 years. I get together once a week with my friend Lockwood Phillips. He's in North Carolina. I'm in London. We talk about world events. This week, we're talking about chemical weapons, Trump and his attack on Syria, North Korea, the French elections, and a host of other topics, including pandas in Amsterdam.
Welcome to Look Ahead Radio with Tom Arms and Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms joining us this afternoon from London, England. By the way, two things. First, this portion of the program has been pre-recorded due to the time frame for our guest, Tom Arms. Also, due to a variety of meetings that I'm going to be participating in this afternoon as well. So with that said, it's always a pleasure to have joining us on Wednesday, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio, heard here every Friday afternoon, as a matter of fact, on the talk station and on radio stations around the world. And with that, Tom, good afternoon, or actually good evening to you in your sphere of the world.
I'll just say hello.
Okay, that'll work. Real quickly, what's the weather like in your community there in London?
I hate to do this to you, 2 weeks running, Lockwood, but blue skies, nothing but blue skies.
So much for that audience.
All day long.
That audience is gone. All right, Tom, there's so much going on around the world. Blue skies there in London, and of course, we've got a lot of events taking place around the world that might darken those clouds and those skies. And of course, of particular concern here in the U.S., particularly in relationship to efforts on the part of President Donald Trump on the topic of Syria, and then of concerns related to Korea. What is the perspective there in the United Kingdom and in Europe, as a matter of fact?
Well, you know, they are, of course, very interested. They're interested in both of them. And you notice The British Foreign Secretary proposed increasing sanctions. This was done in conjunction with the U.S. They proposed it to the G7, and yet a majority of the G7 countries said, no, not yet. Let's wait and see. We don't want to back Russia into a corner, because when the bear's backed into a corner, it may just lash out in an unexpected manner. So let's see how Mr. Tillerson's trip to Moscow goes before we make any further decisions, I think, is the general consensus, except for the British. And as for North Korea, well, everyone's holding their breath.
No, this is interesting. In light of the fact that Russia is itself pretty strapped, it's been helping out Syria. There's some question about its economy. And in light of the fact that the Russian government is being challenged internally, why would not the European community see this as an opportunity to, if you will, do some serious negotiation?
Well, I think we have to try and look at this from the Russian perspective. And I think that's how the Europeans are looking at it. And the Russians really want to be a superpower again. They want to be a great power. This is very important to them. It's especially important to Putin because it's his raison d'etre. It's why he's still there in power, why he's still reasonably popular. He's not delivering economically. He's not delivering in terms of human rights and political freedoms. But he is giving the country pride after its collapse after the Cold War. So, you know, if you start from that premise, perhaps understand a little bit more about what he's trying to do and why he is doing it. And the only way he can really, you know, establish that pride is by establishing influence in the Middle East and establishing influence in Eastern Europe.
The question, of course, goes to the gas attack in Syria and the reaction on the part of the United States. I want to get a quick analysis on that. But doesn't that something that would cause the European community to be a little apoplectic?
And they were. And you recall, if you read the responses immediately after the gas attack, was this great round of applause for Donald Trump from all the Europeans. the only ones who did not applaud the gas attack were the Iranians and the Russians.
And
the Syrians.
All right.
Didn't applaud U.S. response to the gas attack.
Okay.
Everyone else thought that Trump did exactly the right thing. Now, the question is, what happens now? And that's where they're saying, let's think about it.
That is a question even I have asked. Obviously, it's a measured response. But now what happens after this, and what lines in the sand do we draw? And I say that not to be flippant. All right. Real quickly, I want to move to Korea in a moment. But question, President Trump's political cachet in Europe. How is that playing out as a result of this reaction?
I think it's definitely gone up a bit.
But I
think they are still very wary because they're a bit bruised after what he said during the campaign and the immediate aftermath. And they were quite interested. They were quite respectful of his response to the gas attack. As I said, though, it's a question of what happens now. Does he go for complete unilateralism, which they would be opposed to? Does he want to put boots on the ground in Syria? It's all open to discussion still. It's up in the air.
Is there some concern that this could escalate into more warfare? And then, of course, the other aspect of this is, how can you have more warfare when you have to have a scorecard to keep up with who's fighting whom and what side has the upper hand? There are ostensibly four different sides in Syria. Is there a concern that this could escalate?
Oh, no, there's more than four. There's hundreds.
Okay.
the rebels are divided into hundreds of different factions.
Wow.
And that, in fact, was, of course, Obama's problem. He didn't like Assad, but he didn't have anyone else really whom he could support. And that's going to be Trump's problem as well.
Let's talk about the Prime Minister, Theresa May, and what is her observations related to President Trump? And this is both an internal issue. How is she feeling? And there have been some concerns that her relationship with the president was chilling. And the other question is, does she see herself in some capacity representing the United States to the rest of the European community?
They tried to do that through Boris Johnson. And the Boris Johnson canceled a trip to Moscow because he didn't want to conflict with Rex Tillerson's trip. But he was given the task, probably by the State Department and Theresa May, to put the case to the G7 conference that they should increase sanctions against Russian figures, especially military types. And the G7 rejected it, especially the Europeans. And a lot of people are saying the reason they rejected it is because Britain is pulling out of the EU, that it doesn't have the same cachet, the same voice that it had before.
That is stunning that a military issue and a humanitarian issue would be overwhelmed by purely an economic issue and a political issue.
No. It's just a matter of they're saying, you know, you just don't have the same weight that you did. And so we're not going to listen to you. If we want to talk to the Americans, we'll talk to the Americans ourselves. We don't need you the way we did before.
The impact of Brexit on London. I read a story, interestingly enough, that London may lose its economic value to the European community and the worldwide. Is there legitimacy to that concern?
Oh, yes. A number of the banks are talking about downgrading their presence in London. And, you know, but it's London is a massive financial center.
Let me interrupt here.
It's like New York losing its financial center.
But you know what? It's not so much the issue of a financial center. It's the fact that London has laws that are distinguishable and are defensible and are, you know, dependable. There's some great value to being in just London alone, not trying to be an Anglophile here. But
It won't lose all of it.
Well,
and you're absolutely right. It won't lose all of it. But they're talking about there's various sections of financing. I can't remember which ones they are exactly. But there are various sections of financing which requires the financiers who do the dealing in those areas to have access to EU markets, direct access, what they call financial passporting. And that is about 20%. Of the trading in London.
That is so...
And
that
it
is,
would probably be better if those were done. They probably might still have their headquarters here in London, but that proportion might move to Dublin or Paris or Frankfurt.
I find that amazing in light of the world of digital technology and the internet and so forth. All right, we'll get back to that in a moment. Just to remind you, our program this afternoon has been pre-recorded. We have Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio here on Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
This is Tom Arms with LookAheadNews.com's expanded world analysis for the week beginning the 17th of April. Look Ahead broadcasts tomorrow's news today so that you can plan to participate. Syria will continue to top the agenda next week, with possible announcements or repercussions timed to coincide either with Syrian Independence Day on Monday or Iran National Army Day on Tuesday. Insight into the thinking of the Trump administration may be provided by General Joseph Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, when he addresses Washington's press club on Friday. On the other side of the world, ousted South Korean President Park will on Monday be formally indicted for corrupt practices. Elections to replace her are scheduled for May the 9th. French presidential elections enter their final week before the first round of voting on Sunday. The top two candidates from a field of 11 face each other in a runoff poll on 7th of May. The most likely pair are centrist candidate Emmanuel Macron and the far-right leader of the National Front Party, Marine Le Pen. Turkey can expect an unsettling week after its constitutional referendum on Sunday. The country went into the vote divided on the issue of near-dictatorial powers for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and is unlikely to emerge united. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma is also in trouble. He faces a no-confidence vote in Parliament on Tuesday. Zuma's latest crisis was sparked by his sacking of popular finance minister Parvin Gordhan. Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, stages an interesting gubernatorial election on Tuesday. The incumbent Christian governor Basuki Purnama is in the runoff and also on trial for insulting the Quran. Venezuela's troubles continue. On Wednesday, the country's largest opposition party, the Democratic Unity Coalition, is scheduled to stage what has been billed as the mother of all marches against the rule of Nicolas Maduro. Germany is due to stage federal elections in the autumn, and observers are closely watching the performance of the far-right, anti-EU, anti-immigrant, Alternative for Deutschland party. On Saturday and Sunday, the AfD holds its federal party convention to choose its candidate for the chancellorship. An Italian court on Thursday is expected to decide on criminal proceedings against oil giant Shell and its Italian partner Eni for allegedly doling out $1 billion in bribes to Nigerian government officials. The IMF World Bank annual spring meeting brings the week to an end as the world's top finance ministers gather in Washington on Friday through Saturday. The meeting will be preceded by the IMF's publication on Tuesday of its annual World Economic Outlook. And that was next week's news today from LookAheadNews.com so that you can plan to participate in the world around you. Stay tuned for Viewpoints Around the World with myself and Lockwood Phillips.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. And by the way, just to remind you, Look Ahead Radio, heard on radio stations around the world, literally, as well as on the talk station every Friday afternoon. Tom, we were chatting a moment ago about the worldview related to Russia and Syria. And you did bring up the topic of Iran very quickly. I want to move to China and North Korea here in just a moment. And of course, again, that cloudy sky. You started off the program swinging blue skies. This is, to me, a cloudy environment. Syria and Iran. What's going to happen? Is Syria going to find itself getting closer allied with Iran? We've got to talk about Turkey, but I'll do
that. I don't think it could be much closer allied than it is.
Really?
It's still very closely. You know, they're practically sleeping in each other's beds at the moment.
So Iran is going to Syria becomes a puppet of Iran.
That's one way of putting it. I don't think either Iran or Syria would use those terms. You could also say that Syria has become a puppet of Russia.
And of course, we've got to get to the topic of Turkey. I want to delay that topic of Turkey here. I want to stay with the issue we were chatting a few moments ago about the U.S. involvement worldwide. And of course, we chatted a few moments ago about the events in Syria. But now let's look to the east, or in your case, you might, well, we would look to the west. You would look to the east. I think it's closer to Korea from that direction, you being in the United Kingdom. What's the first opinion of the European community and the world community on the saber rattling that's underway right now between North Korea and the United States?
Everyone's extremely worried. I mean, you know, you've got the United States now involved in two major conflicts on two opposite ends of the world. You know, the danger being overextended, the danger of basically being pushed into a decision, not necessarily of your own making. It's growing almost daily. And again, here we have to look at it because the other major player is China. And the big worry is not so much what will North Korea do, but what will China do if North Korea is attacked? I mean, let's just say that, you know, there is a decision to attack the nuclear facilities, assuming that the CIA knows exactly where they are, and take those out before there is any more development, which is not, you know, beyond the possibility. One, if they did that, then North Korea also has the facility with conventional weapons to basically level a big portion of South Korea with an artillery barrage. And of course, that would then result in an attack on North Korea. China doesn't want that.
No, no.
It doesn't want that because America would win.
Well, not only that, China has two issues. One, its economy, while good, it has some weaknesses and it needs world trade. And a war of this nature would shut world trade down. That's my observation. Number two, and please correct me if I'm wrong. Number two, China is not happy with North Korea on its northern border. And I know that the Chinese have been very, very concerned about the flow of refugees that would overwhelm that region of China. Is that not really the driving issue for China? I mean, really, China has used Korea as a surrogate on numerous occasions.
It doesn't want North Korea to fail either. The problem is that if it withdraws all support from North Korea, then the regime, the communist regime there, would probably collapse. The Korean Peninsula would be united under the auspices of the South Koreans. And the Americans would probably then move their systems, their defense systems and everything else, further up the Korean Peninsula to be closer to the Chinese border. They don't want that either.
That is
also they don't want the United States being seen to win in their backyard.
That is such a long-range concern. I find it hard to comprehend.
The Chinese are noted. They pride themselves on thinking long range.
Well, that is definitely long range. All right, let's talk about the impact this may have on the United Kingdom's efforts related to relationships with China. You were the UK was trying to develop greater trade relations. What about the impact on trade with Europe and China? Is this Korean saber rattling a concern economically?
Well, of course, if you know, there's anything that disrupts trade, it's going to have an effect on Europe. You know, recently, I don't know if you heard of the Silk Road, but that was a medieval route, in fact, much longer than medieval, went right back to Roman times, that linked China to Europe. And they have effectively reopened the Silk Road. They built a railway. That railway now runs all the way, the railway service runs all the way to London.
That is an amazing, and by the way, I did see a picture of the train. Let's talk then for a few more moments here, Tom, and again, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com, Look Ahead Radio with us this evening. The issue of NATO amidst all of this saber rattling, is NATO, if you will, stepping up? Is there any activity, any news on NATO and its relationship to either of these potential conflicts?
At this stage, no. No, nothing yet. There's been no meetings of NATO foreign ministers. It's too early, I think.
Well, it's interesting because NATO, of course, was one of the great concerns with the decision of or the election of Donald Trump and the fear that NATO would be, well, become hollowed out. I'm just wondering if Europe has expressed any further interest in supporting NATO or, in fact, creating a separate military endeavor.
Well, they're still working on it. And I, you know, how much, I mean, their preferred system is the old system.
Okay.
And that is that the old transatlantic relationship. That is their preferred system. But if there is a withdrawal by the United States, by the U.S. administration, then they would be forced into setting up a European army, if you like.
All right. We'll get to more issues here in just a moment with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. We now return to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Just to remind you, this portion has been pre-recorded. Tom, we were chatting a few moments ago, and I want to jump off subject very quickly, and we'll get back to China here. But on the topic of Syria, and there have been some concerns and observations by a variety of pundits that, in fact, the gas attack in Syria might have been established through Russian contacts in an effort to, if you will, build up President Trump's reputation. I'm curious, has that thought been lofted there in the United Kingdom or in Europe, or is that just a matter of politics here in the U.S.? It seems a little strange.
No, I haven't heard that here.
Okay.
The only thing I heard, which you thought was egregious when I mentioned it, was that perhaps the talk of creating better relations or possibly not prioritizing the removal of Assad encouraged him to be
a
bit more aggressive.
Right. But here's
encourage the chemical weapons attack. That he thought it was, if not exactly a carte blanche, it was a bit of an open door, which he leapt through.
Okay.
Precipitously.
There are two questions associated with that. Very quickly. First one is, we are now reminded that Russia said that they had removed all of the chemical agents and gases from Syria. Now, of course, we discover they had not been removed, or had they been given back to Syria? That's question number one. And question number two, which is kind of associated with that, is when this was used, was there any effort to hold Russia accountable by the European community?
I don't know about the latter.
Okay.
But I've said time and time again that Putin's credibility in the international field is zero.
Yes.
You know, he has lied consistently on any number of issues. And I never particularly believed that they did away with the chemical weapons. I really, you know, his credibility is even lower than low.
And by the way, this
dropped below basement level.
This event alone raises some serious questions. And of course, I will have to say it raises questions about the relationships initiated under the Obama administration, particularly with Susan Rice and also John Kerry, Secretary of State at the time, that these chemicals had been removed. But that is a topic that is beginning to be questioned here in the States, as well as how that all occurred. Since we're talking about Syria, let's talk about Turkey for a moment, a next door neighbor. First question, is Turkey changing its relationship with Russia as a result of that gas attack? And then we have an election coming up. So first question, what's been Turkey's reaction to this? Because I know that Erdogan had the president had complimented the president of the United States on the missile attack. So Turkey's been trying to be friendly with Russia. You know, it's hard to keep up with.
He's flip-flopping
everywhere.
Erdogan is flip-flopping everywhere. You know, he's like a pillow. You know, he bears the impression of a last person who slept on him. And it's very difficult to, you know, he's like Jell-O. You're trying to tack Jell-O to the wall with Erdogan. His positions are constantly changing. You can't trust the man.
Yeah, I've come to the conclusion, Tom, that you are becoming
anyone.
You're a real cynic. Yes, you don't trust anyone. And I'll tell you what, there are a lot of people here in the United
States. Lockwood.
Thank you. There are a lot of other people in the States who agree with you. All right, so we've got him flip-flopping. What impact does this have on his interest in becoming a member of the European Union?
None okay. whatsoever. He has really blotted his copybook, as we say over
okay.
here.
All right.
As far as the European Union is concerned, in so many ways.
All right. Let me. We don't need to belabor that. Let's talk about the referendum that's coming up soon.
It's on Sunday. It's going to be very close. It's 50-50.
Really?
Let's just say what he hopes to get out of it. He hopes to become an executive president, but one with more power than almost any other executive president in any so-called democracy. He will have the power to appoint all the judges without any parliamentary oversight. There'll no longer be a prime minister. He'd be allowed to rule by decree. He can declare a state of emergency without parliament's approval. He will be allowed to appoint senior academic and military positions without any parliamentary oversight.
Let me interrupt you on this one without going into the details. My question to you and to the European Union is, so big deal. It's dictatorial. We've dealt with dictators in the past. As a matter of fact, worldwide, we're going to have to deal with dictators. Is this something that really disturbs the European Union? I don't want to get into the details, but is this something that's very disturbing to them?
Yes. Okay. Although I said that he'd blotted his copybook as far as European membership is concerned, it's still there. It's always there in the background. There are a lot of people who would like Turkey to be part of Europe, but they can't let Turkey be part of Europe unless it joins the Democratic Club. Okay. That is a rule.
All right. And so this is one of the issues that we're going to be paying close attention to. I want to get back to the European Union for a quick second. The issues in France, Germany, elections there as well. How heated are those elections coming? And is the European Union the primary topic of discussion and debate?
No. In France, maybe with... Yeah, I suppose it is in France. I have a funny story about France, though, the French elections. Mm-hmm. And that is the far-left candidate, whose name is Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who's backed by the Communist Party. A group of his supporters got together, and they've made a video game election called Fiscal Combat, in which their candidate goes around prowling the streets of Paris, shaking down rich people and his political opponents for money to go into his campaign fund.
I see this as an opportunity in the States as well. Since we're talking about elections and campaign and possibly corruption, you have a note here about corruption in the Ukraine. What's going on there?
Well, the central bank, they really have a big problem with corruption in Ukraine. I mean, billions go missing. And the entire economy, most of the economy is controlled by an oligarchy very similar to Russia's.
And so we've been concerned.
A lot of nepotism. They had their economy minister resigned about 6 months ago. And now the governor of the central bank has quit, basically because she's not getting the support. She's getting death threats and things like that. It's a real problem because we're having to prop up that regime, even though it has problems with human rights, has problems with corruption.
Here's the final analysis on that, Tom. Tom Arms, of course, of Look Ahead Radio and lookaheadnews.com. You know, we're talking about that in democratic societies and democratic cultures. Great Britain, Western Europe, majority parliamentary cultures there. You know, the reality is we're, as multiple and diverse nations, are just going to have to learn to deal with corruption and dictatorial powers. I go back to my earlier question about the European Union setting these standards. It's obviously a subtle effort to influence these nations. Is it going to work? Final analysis, or let's put it this way, that's speculative on your part, but is it going to work? Do these national leaders actually think that this kind of influence can be altered?
Well, it has worked in some countries. Certainly the Baltic states are, you know, models of democracy.
All right. So, but that took a war. That took a war. And by the way,
we're talking about the Cold War.
I'm talking about World War II.
After World War II, there were models of democracy before World War II, between 1920 and 1940. Mm-hmm. They then became communist satellites or Soviet satellites. And then when the Soviet Union collapsed, they became model democracies again.
But that was
there are other countries in Eastern Europe which are actually doing quite well in democratic terms. May not be doing as well as others, but they're doing quite well.
But it took major events. It took warfare, it took Cold War, and Cold War was a continuation of World War II. That's my theory. But there was major oppression and challenges. All right. I want to go very quickly to another quick item before we take this break. We have the end of Zuma in South Africa.
Well, I'm not saying he's going to end, but he's having problems. He's 75 today.
Wow.
And the people of South Africa are celebrating by marching through the streets of Pretoria, Cape Town, and Johannesburg, protesting, demanding his resignation. Okay. That's how they're celebrating his 75th birthday.
Well, again, we're talking about a country that may have major alterations in the near term, are we not?
They may. What's happened recently is he has sacked his finance minister, and his finance minister was one of the last bastions against corruption and nepotism in South Africa. Zuma himself is still under charges for rape, corruption, nepotism, and racketeering.
I'll leave it at that. I think that's a great way to end this segment with you, Tom Arms of Look Ahead News and Look Ahead Radio, lookaheadnews.com, by the way, in light of the fact that we're chatting about how governments are being managed and dictators and oppressive natures. It's part, unfortunately, of the fabric of the world. You're listening to lookaheadnews.com host and writer Tom Arms, and of course Look Ahead Radio, where he is the host every Friday here on the talk station and radio stations around the world, viewpoints around the world.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
Observations of an Expat by Tom Arms from lookaheadnews.com. What now in Syria? Will Russia drop its support for Assad? Will the US intervene? Will Assad stay in power? Almost certainly the answers are no, no, and yes. President Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin will stick with Assad for a host of reasons. They are good reasons from his viewpoint, and bad reasons from the point of view of most of the rest of the world. But Putin is very much a Russia first man, and he's prepared to lie, cheat, steal, kill, corrupt, even back an evil, chemical weapon-dropping animal to pursue what he perceives as his country's national interests and stay in power. When it comes to human rights and political freedom, Putin has been exposed as a failure. When it comes to combating corruption, he's a dismal failure. And as for the economy, well, it's just starting a fragile growth after a long contraction. In one area, however, Putin is hugely successful: foreign military adventures. His success in Crimea, eastern Ukraine, and Syria have delighted the patriotic Russian people. His consistently high domestic approval ratings are the envy of other world leaders. Backing down in Syria will send those approval ratings plummeting, and Putin, who faces elections next March, could lose his grip on power. There are other good geostrategic reasons for backing Assad. For Russia, the road back to the top diplomatic table is through Damascus. It has already provided a key relationship with Iran, opened doors with Turkey, and left it with a military base in the center of the pivotal Middle East. With this military and political power comes influence and eventually economic benefits. So will Putin drop his support for Assad? No, he can't. And the Trump administration will not intervene in Syria. It will continue airstrikes, maybe even launch special forces actions every time a red line is crossed. Trump may even lay down a few more not-to-be-crossed red lines. But American boots on the ground are not on the cards. And for good reasons. Trying to depose Assad is a quagmire far deeper and dangerous than Vietnam, Afghanistan, or Iraq. It was not always so. Back in 2012, there was a window of opportunity for direct intervention by the West. That was before the Syrian opposition fragmented into hundreds of factions that spent as much time fighting each other as they did Assad. However, after Iraq and Afghanistan, there was no public appetite for Western intervention. By the time Obama drew his red line in August 2012, the window was rapidly closing. When the first chemical weapons were dropped in March 2013, it was closed and nailed shut. But it should be said that a surgical strike along the lines of the one ordered by Donald Trump would probably have deterred Putin from sending in his air force and the Iranians from sending in tens of thousands of ground troops. The Russians and Iranians would have shied away from the danger of the Syrian civil war escalating from a proxy conflict to a shooting war with NATO troops on the other side. And if Donald Trump is able to discover hidden reservoirs of common sense, he will shy away from direct intervention for the same good reason. That is why Assad will stay in power. Russian and Iranian intervention has been a game-changer in the Syrian civil war. Before Putin flew to the rescue, Assad's regime was on the verge of collapse. Aleppo and most of Damascus had fallen to the rebel forces. Now Aleppo is back in the hands of the regime, as is most of Damascus. And the Russians have been organizing peace talks without the Americans. Maintaining Assad in power was the reason the Russians entered the fray. Forcing his removal, no matter how great his crimes, would make a mockery of their involvement. So the West should stop insisting on his departure. It isn't going to happen, at least not for some time. And continually demanding it just highlights our failures when the demands are ignored.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and also Look Ahead Radio, heard on this station and stations around the world. Tom, we've got a few minutes left in the program, and I want to chat with you about some interesting aspects of the agenda today. You've got a quiet expansion of the United Arab Emirates. What are we talking about there?
Well, it's really interesting. Mad Dog Mattis, by the way, before he became Secretary of Defense, referred to the United Arab Emirates as Little Sparta.
Right.
And they are quietly extending their influence. They now control 13 ports, not in the United Arab Emirates, but 13 ports stretching from the Persian Gulf around the coast of the Arabian Sea to the Red Sea and right up to the start of the Suez Canal. And so they are becoming a major regional power. Now, some of these ports, they've simply negotiated the rights to manage them, as they did in part of Somalia, or they have simply won them by feet of arms, as they did in Aden.
Well, part of this is the effort on the United Arab Emirates to expand their economic opportunities. To that they're so reliant on oil, and it strikes me that this is a new approach to economic stability. Or am I misreading this?
That's part of it. I think the control of the ports beyond the UAE is more of a question of political influence and protecting the trade routes.
Okay.
They have expanded their or diversified their economy, mainly in Dubai, by turning it into a major financial center and holiday destination. And they've done that very successfully. And so I think in those terms, there's no question. But they need to what they want to do is extend the political influence that comes with the financial influence, so that they can protect the region as a whole and make it as secure as possible.
Very interesting. A new regional power and a growing worldwide power, the United Arab Emirates. Let's talk about two items left with a few minutes left to go in the program with you, Tom. Personality cult in China. Very quickly, before we get to the panda story, which applies nicely, tell us about the personality cult.
Well, you know, you had a personality cult under Mao, and he was followed by Deng Xiaoping. And Deng Xiaoping made it clear that never again would they have a personality cult, that it wasn't the right thing for a communist country and certainly not for China. Well, apparently people are now having to swear fealty to the new president, Xi Jinping.
That's significant.
It's part of their oath now. If you are a senior person in the military or the Communist Party, a new thing is you swear loyalty not only to the party, not only to the state, but also personally to the president, Xi Jinping, who is named.
This is an amazing...
And so there are fears that he's trying to revive personality cult around himself.
This is an amazing story. And of course, it just closes the circle in the conversation we've had about other leaders worldwide. All right, let's wrap it up, since we're in China, as it were, about Panda Mad in Amsterdam.
As we speak, two pandas, giant pandas, Jing Ya and Wu Wen, are about to touch down at Schiphol Airport and become residents of Amsterdam's zoo, National Zoo. It's their first pandas.
Are these refugees by any chance?
No, they're not refugees. But you can imagine they're going absolutely panda mad. Children are out there waving panda flags. You know, they're all screaming, you know, panda mad songs and in Dutch and so forth. I want to add that the giant pandas in September were moved off the endangered species list.
Ooh, all right.
They're no longer endangered species.
Interesting. Okay, is this China's outreach for greater diplomacy by any chance?
Oh, yes. No. Panda diplomacy is well known as far as China's concerned. And this was a result of a visit by the Dutch royal family to China. They were told, but it took 12 years for them to negotiate all the terms for the panda. The Chinese are very fussy about this. They go over, they set up the panda enclosure. They make certain everybody is thoroughly trained. They select the pandas well in advance. They get the pandas ready. They're very, very thorough. And in fact, the pandas don't actually belong to the Dutch. They are still Chinese property.
On loan. I can appreciate that. All right. Tom Arms. This is amazing. Tom Arms of lookaheadnews.com. By the way, sign up. Tomorrow's news today. He does that magically, but that's lookaheadnews.com and, of course, Look Ahead Radio here on Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio is a production of The Talk Station.